C, corporation taxation. Now, when you took regulation, you obviously had to study C corp tax, but it was kind of at a surface level. Not so the case with TCP. So we are going to get into it, and you're going to love it. Promise. All right. So forming a C corp. To form a C corp, shareholders, they transfer assets such as cash, property, services to the corp in return for shares in the company's stock. So you give the corporation cash, property, or a service, and then you get stock in the corporation. So we are going to look at things such as gain or loss for the shareholder, the shareholder's basis in the stock, the gain or loss for the corporation, and then the corporation's basis in the property. And there's a whole bunch of scenarios that we're going to walk through here. So we begin with the issuance of stock in exchange for cash. From the shareholder's perspective, there's no gain or loss. It's non-taxable to the shareholder. Their basis in stock is the amount of cash paid for the stock. Corporation, the issuance of stock is a non-taxable event. The basis in their cash, well, that's always the value of the cash received. Simple enough. This is when it starts to get interesting. The issuance of stock in exchange for property. So when a shareholder contributes property in exchange for stock, the shareholder is investing in the C corp, who is raising capital. However, the issuance of stock in exchange for property is taxable under certain circumstances, which we will go over right now. When the contributors of cash and property obtain less than 80% control, when there is boot received by the shareholder along with the stock, and when mortgage debt is transferred by the shareholder and that mortgage debt exceeds the basis of the property. So a non-taxable transfer is when the contributors of cash and property to the corporation obtain more than 80% control, 80% or more. It becomes taxable when it's less than 80% control, boot is received, and the mortgage debt exceeds the basis in the property. So in our first scenario is when a shareholder contributes cash and property and the shareholders obtain more than 80% control. It's a non-taxable event. And all contributors of cash and property have more than 80% control of the corporation. From the shareholder's perspective, the issuance of stock in exchange for property is non-taxable for the shareholders if all of the contributors of cash and property have more than 80% control of the corporation. To calculate the gain realized, you take the fair market value of the property minus the basis of the property, and that's the gain realized. Gain recognized, no gain is recognized. Now, their basis in the stock is calculated as follows. Take the basis of the property contributed minus any mortgage debt given up, because if you're relieved of debt, then that will lower your basis. So basis of the property contributed minus any mortgage debt. Or if there's no mortgage, then your basis in the stock equals your basis of the property contributed. From the corporation's perspective, the issuance of stock is non-taxable. So the corporation is receiving property in exchange for the issuance of stock. So what is the corporation's basis in the property? Well, it's the shareholder's carryover basis. And the corporation's holding period for the property would also be the shareholder's carryover holding period. They inherit it from the shareholder. Now, the next scenario is when contributors of cash and property obtain less than 80% control of the corporation. This is a taxable event. Now, the gain realized, the fair market value of the property contributed, minus the basis of that property, is the gain realized. And the gain recognized is the gain realized. It's fully recognized. So there's a gain. Now, the shareholder's basis in the stock that they received is calculated as follows. The basis of the property contributed minus any mortgage debt given up plus the gain recognized. So if there's no mortgage debt, then it's basis of property plus the gain recognized. That's the individual shareholder's basis in the stock. From the corporation's perspective, issuance of stock is non-taxable. So what is their basis? It's the carryover basis of the property plus the gain recognized by the shareholder. And the corporation's holding period is also the shareholder's carryover holding period. Next scenario, boot is received by the shareholder along with stock, taxable event. So boot is any property received by a shareholder that isn't the stock of the corporation. It can be cash, other property. Relief of debt is not considered boot. So from the shareholder's perspective, the gain realized is the lesser of the gain realized or boot received. Remember, the fair market value of the property minus the basis of the property contributed, that's the gain realized. And the gain recognized is the lesser of the gain realized or the boot received. The shareholder's basis in the stock is the basis of the property that was contributed minus any mortgage debt given up plus any gain recognized minus any boot received. So when boot enters the picture, it's factored in to the shareholder's basis in the C-Corp stock. Basis of property contributed minus mortgage debt given up plus any gain recognized minus boot received. From the corporation's perspective, again, the issuance of stock is non-taxable. And the corporation's basis in the property is the shareholder's carryover basis plus the gain recognized. And the corporation inherits the shareholder's carryover holding period. Next is a situation where a shareholder contributes property that has a mortgage, but the mortgage debt exceeds their basis in the property that they are contributing, and that's taxable. And so to calculate the gain, you take the mortgage debt minus the basis in the property, and that's the total gain realized, and the gain is fully recognized. Now, their basis in the stock then is their basis of property contributed minus the mortgage debt given up plus the gain recognized, which should equal zero. From the corporation's perspective, again, issuance of stock is non-taxable, and their basis is the shareholder's carryover basis in the property plus the gain recognized. And again, corporation inherits the shareholder's carryover holding period. Now, what about if the carryover basis of the property is more than the fair market value of the property? That's non-taxable. So when a shareholder transfers property in exchange for the stock, and the carryover basis of the property is more than the fair market value, in other words, the property has built-in losses, then the corporation's basis in the property is limited to the fair market value of the property. So from the shareholder's perspective, it's a non-taxable event. The loss that's realized is the fair market value of the property minus the basis of the property is the loss realized and the loss recognized, no loss is recognized. Their basis in the C Corp stock is the basis of the property contributed minus the mortgage debt given up. From the corporation's perspective, the issuance of stock is not taxable, and the corporation's basis in the property received is the fair market value of the property, because it's the shareholder's carryover basis for the property minus the loss realized by the shareholder. And the corporation inherits the shareholder's carryover holding period. And the final scenario is where there's an issuance of stock in exchange for services. From the shareholder's perspective, if shares are issued in exchange for services, then the fair market value of the stock received is treated as ordinary income to the shareholder, because essentially they are performing a service just like you would a job, and instead of getting paid cash, you're getting paid stock. So it's treated as ordinary income. Their basis in that stock is the fair market value of the stock received. From the corporation's perspective, if shares are issued in exchange for services, then the fair market value of the stock issued is treated as an ordinary expense to the corporation, and there's no basis in services. So that's a summary of the various tax treatments and basis calculations, both from the shareholder's perspective and the corporation's perspective. We will now turn to C Corporation filing requirements, beginning with Form 1120. All C Corps must file a Form 1120, even if they have no taxable income. And the 1120 is due 3.5 months after the close of the tax year. So for a calendar tax year, which is January to December, the return is due on April 15th, give or take. Tax accounting basis, cash versus accrual. So yes, corporations can use cash basis if they have average annual gross receipts of $29 million or less during the preceding 3 years. Otherwise, they have to use accrual basis. Tax shelters must also use accrual basis. Amended returns. So a C Corp can amend their return or claim a refund up to the later of 3 years after the filing date, or if they applied for an extension, use the extension date, or 2 years after the tax payment date. IRS statute of limitations. So the IRS can audit an individual, corporation, etc., but there's a window in which they have to do it. And the statute of limitations goes like this. If it's for an error or simple negligence, they have 3 years after the later of the due date or the filing date. So if you file, if a corporation files an extension, then it starts 3 years from the date the return is filed. If it's for gross negligence, which is a substantial understatement of income, which is omitting more than 25% of the income reported on the return, then they have 6 years to challenge the return. If it's fraud or a failure to file, there is no time limit. Moving on to consolidated tax returns. So a consolidated tax return is a return of affiliated C Corps who elect to combine their tax liability on a single return. And so if one corporation has 80% of the total voting power of all classes of stock of another corporation or groups of corporations, or 80% of the total value of all classes of stock, they can file a consolidated return. And so parents and subs can file their consolidated return. C Corps cannot consolidate with S Corps and brother-sister entities. This is when five or fewer individuals who are individuals, trusts, estates, and they own 80% of the voting power of the stock, brother, sister entities cannot file a consolidated return. Some advantages of filing a consolidated return would be tax optimization, administrative efficiency, loss utilization. So this allows for the net operating losses to flow across the group. Intercompany transactions gives more flexibility with that. Some disadvantages would be joint and several liability. So if one corporation within the group does something that they shouldn't, then it could in fact impact the others. And filing a consolidated return adds more complexity, and so there's all of the intercompany transactions, carry forwards, carry backs. It's good job security for a CPA. And then finally, there's increased audit risk. So the more complex the return, then the more of a chance for the higher the audit risk, the higher the risk that the IRS will want to do an audit. And consolidated returns, they can be subject to a higher level of scrutiny by the IRS. Moving on to an overview of the Form 1120. So the formula for 1120 to get to total tax liability, just real quick, I'm going to run through it, and then we're going to go through each one in detail. You have gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contribution deductions, giving you income before net operating loss deduction and the special deduction, minus net operating loss deduction, giving you income before the special deductions, minus dividend received deduction, giving you taxable income, times the tax rate, giving you gross tax liability, minus tax credits, minus estimated tax payments, plus underpayment penalties, plus accumulated earnings tax or personal holding company tax, whatever the case may be, plus the BEAT, which is base erosion anti-abuse tax, giving you total tax liability. So we begin with gross income and inclusions in gross income. This is gross profit, which is net receipts minus cost of sales, giving you gross profit. Then dividends. So dividends received by a corporation are included in gross income, which is why we then later have the dividend received deduction. Interest, rent, and royalties. Imputed interest on below market rate loans between a corporation and a shareholder. So this is when, so it's a loan made between two parties, and when you loan someone money, it's expected that you will charge them an interest rate that aligns with current market rates. However, if the loan is made with a rate below the market interest rate, which is common with loans between shareholders and corporations, where the lender isn't looking to make a profit, might even offer a 0% loan. Well, this is where imputed interest comes in. So the IRS treats this loan as if it had been made and with charging the market rate of interest, and then they gifted the value of that interest back to the borrower. So the difference between the interest the taxpayer should have charged and the interest that the taxpayer actually charged is imputed interest. And this imputed interest is then considered income to the lender, even though they never received it. So that's imputed interest. So that is included in gross income. Net capital gains. So capital gains, net of capital losses, are included in gross income. Corporations, unlike individuals, can only offset capital gains with capital losses. They cannot net capital losses to offset ordinary income. That's a noted distinction between an individual and a corporation. Net capital losses can be carried back 3 years and carried forward 5 years. Back in the day, the corporate tax rate was 35%. And so that was one of my memory aids to remember capital losses was back 3, 4, 5, it's no longer 35%. But if that's helpful, you can a net capital loss can be carried back 3 years and carried forward 5. Capital losses that are carried forward or back, they are treated as short term. Then exclusions from gross income, you have state muni and U.S. possession bonds and proceeds on key person life insurance policies. Because corporations will often take out life insurance policies on their key employees or executives to prevent against financial loss if that person were to die. And the corporation pays the premiums on these key person policies, and the corporation is also the beneficiary. So the premiums are not deductible by the corporation, and the proceeds of these loans are not taxable and therefore not included in gross income. So in our overview of Form 1120, that was gross income. Next, we will talk about ordinary deductions. A corporation is allowed to deduct ordinary and necessary expenses during the taxable year, just like any type of business. And there are deductible and non-deductible business expenses. Deductible business expenses include employee compensation, like salaries, wages, payroll tax, bonus, vacation pay, life insurance premiums, fringe benefits, like meals, transportation benefits. So meals that are provided to employees in an employer-operated eating facility are 50% deductible, assuming they're provided for the convenience of the employer. So, and a company doesn't want their employees like leaving at lunch because it's, you know, they want them to eat and then get back at it. And so so those meals are 50% deductible. Transportation benefits. So if a company basically pays for transportation to and from work, like an executive limo, that's not deductible anymore. I wish I had one of those. Executive compensation. So publicly held corporations can deduct up to a maximum of $1 million of comp for each covered employee, which includes the CEO, CFO, and the three other highest compensated officers. Once an employee is considered a covered employee, they remain a covered employee for all future years. So they can deduct up to a maximum of $1 million. Bad debts. So bad debts can never be deducted for cash basis taxpayers, as the amount has not been included in income. But they can be deducted through accrual basis, with accrual basis accounting using the direct write-off method. Business rent is deductible. However, it's not allowed as a deduction until the period passes. In other words, the expense is accrued. Taxes. There are some deductible taxes and some non-deductible taxes. Deductible taxes include state, local, federal payroll tax, foreign taxes on which the foreign tax credit is not claimed. And then the rest is not deductible for the most part. Interest expense. So business interest expense is tax deductible. This is interest on loans taken out for business activities and purchase of business property or equipment. Investment interest expense. So interest expense on loans used to purchase investments is tax deductible, but only to the extent of the corporation's net investment income. However, if the borrowed funds are used to invest in tax-free securities, the interest expense related to that loan is not deductible because you're not paying tax on the investment. Another deduction is depreciation. So maker's depreciation, section 179, bonus depreciation, those are deductions. Amortization, so intangibles like goodwill, trademark, franchises, patents, copyrights, covenants not to compete, etc. Those are amortized over 180 months on the straight line basis, beginning in the month in which it is acquired. Depletion is allowed for natural resources like minerals, oil. There's two basic methods for this, which we'll cover later in property tax. Research and experimental costs. So this is deductible, but it's treated differently depending on if the research and experimental costs are done in the U.S. or outside of the U.S. So if they're done inside of the U.S., they're capitalized and amortized over 5 years. If they're done outside of the U.S., then it's 15 years. So there's a significant tax incentive to do it within the U.S. because you get to deduct it faster. Another deduction is organizational cost and startup expenses. So organizational costs are costs like forming the corporation, filing with the Secretary of State, etc. Then startup costs like market research, advertising, etc. Those can be deducted up to $5,000, but they are reduced dollar for dollar once you exceed $50,000 for startup costs, and then the remaining balance has to be amortized over 180 months. Business meals. So these are meals with clients or customers, traveling for business, at a conference, etc. 50% deductible. Business travel expenses like airfare, hotel, car rentals, etc. are deductible. Business gifts. They are deductible up to $25 per person per year. Casualty losses. This is for damage, destruction due to a sudden, unexpected act, hurricane, etc. And this is the end. And to claim a casualty loss, it's generally the lesser of the decline in the fair market value of the asset or the adjusted basis in the property, and then minus insurance proceeds, giving you the casualty loss. So if insurance reimbursed the corporation, then that has to be backed out because you can't double dip. The $100 floor and the 10% of AGI limitations that apply for individuals do not apply to corporations. And then one final threshold, it has to be in a federally declared disaster area. So those were deductible business expenses. Now we will discuss non-deductible business expenses. Business entertainment, so tickets to a sporting event, golf outings, etc., not deductible. Fines and penalties, not deductible. Membership dues. So amounts paid for a membership for like a social purpose, like country clubs, hotel clubs, sporting clubs, airline clubs, etc., are not deductible. However, if a corporation pays for dues for like a civic organization like Rotary or something like that, trade associations, those are deductible. Basically, if it's for entertainment, golf, etc., not deductible. So going back to our overview of Form 1120, we've discussed gross income and then minus ordinary deductions, which is what we just discussed. Next are charitable contributions. So C-Corps can deduct charitable contributions that they make within a tax year, but it must be made to a qualifying organization per the IRS. These deductions are limited to 10% of adjusted taxable income, which is gross income minus ordinary business expenses minus any net operating loss carry forward minus any capital loss carry forward, giving you adjusted taxable income. So that's the basis for the 10% charitable contribution deduction. Any excess charitable contributions above and beyond the 10% limit, they can be carried forward for 5 years. One little note on charitable contributions that's unique to a corporation are accrued charitable contributions. They can be deducted in the year they are made. So this is essentially a promise. As long as they are paid by the corporation's tax return due date, not including extensions, then pledges to make a charitable contribution by the end of its tax year can take deductions in that tax year as long as it fulfills the pledge and makes the actual payment by the time it files its tax return for that year without extensions. So essentially, basically, April 15th. And note the difference there between us as individual taxpayers and a corporation. We cannot deduct our pledged charitable contributions. We can only deduct what we actually pay during the tax year. Okay, so that was charitable contributions. Going back to our Form 1120, we had gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contribution deductions, giving us income before net operating loss and special deductions, like the dividend received deduction. Now, we will discuss the net operating loss deduction. So this is a situation when a C-Corp's allowable tax deductions exceed its taxable income within a tax year, so the business has incurred a loss for tax purposes, and the NOL, the net operating loss, can be valuable because it can be used to offset taxable income in other years. And so C-Corps, like individuals, can carry forward a net operating loss indefinitely, but can only use it to offset 80% of the taxable income in a given year, with any remaining NOL continuing to be carried forward indefinitely. So an NOL carryback, not allowed. NOL carried forward indefinitely, but can only offset 80% of taxable income. One item of note for net operating losses, and this is in the case of an ownership change. So in theory, a corporation could acquire another corporation with significant net operating losses and then immediately utilize those to offset its own taxable income. Now, the IRS says, not so fast. There's something called Section 382, and this prevents a corporation from doing that for the most part. There are some small exceptions, but the broad concept is that a corporation can't acquire another corporation just strictly for no business purpose other than to suck their net operating losses and utilize them. Okay, going back to our Form 1120, we had gross income, we had ordinary deductions, we had charitable contribution deductions, then we had, which gave us our income before net operating losses and our dividend received deduction, then we had our net operating loss deduction, which we just talked about, giving us income before special deductions. Now we will discuss the dividend received deduction. So this is a tax deduction available to corporations that receive dividends from other corporations. It's designed to prevent triple taxation because Corporation A pays tax on the income, which is tax one. Corporation B pays tax on the dividend, tax two. And then income is distributed to the individual shareholders as dividends. Then they pay tax on the dividend, which is tax number three. So basically, if a corporation owns 0 to 20% of the voting rights in another corporation, they get a 50% dividend received deduction. For 20 to 80%, you get a 65% dividend receive deduction, and then more than 80%, you get a 100% dividend received deduction. Okay, going back to Form 1120, and if you haven't figured it out yet, I'm not doing this to be annoying or unnecessarily repetitive. We're going through it so that hopefully by the end of this, you'll mentally have the flow of the Form 1120. So we had gross income, then ordinary deductions, then charitable contribution deductions, giving us income before net operating loss. Then we had our net operating loss, giving us income before dividend received deduction. Then we had our dividend received deduction, which we just talked about, giving us taxable income. Then we take that times the corporate tax rate, which is currently 21%, giving us gross tax liability. Then we back out tax credits, which is our next topic. So there are various tax credits. We have the foreign tax credit, and this is available to U.S. corporations for income taxes paid to foreign countries on income tax that is on income that is also reported on the U.S. tax return. So it's calculated, the foreign tax credit is calculated as actual foreign taxes paid, but it's subject to the following limitation. The U.S. tax liability times a ratio, and the ratio is foreign income divided by worldwide income. And what to know about the foreign tax credit in excess of the limitation, it can be carried back 1 year and carried forward 10 years. So that was the foreign tax credit. Then we have general business credits, such as work opportunity credit, investment credits, low-income housing credit, employer-provided child care credit, welfare-to-work credit, a lot of credits. And these vary from credit to credit. They are generally calculated as a percentage of eligible expenses, investments, or wages. So what I would know about general business credits in excess of the limitation, of any limitations, they can be carried back 1 year and carried forward 20 years. So foreign tax credit, back one, forward 10. General business credit, back one, forward 20. Then there's the investment tax credit for semiconductor manufacturing facilities and equipment. That's a biggie. Well, it's not biggie in scope on the exam. It's a mouthful, rather. And what I would know about this specific credit, the investment tax credit for semiconductor manufacturing facilities and equipment, is that it is available to both domestic and foreign companies, and it's refundable. So if you get quizzed on a refundable credit, just remember it's the one that has to do with semiconductors. So going back to our Form 1120, gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contribution deductions, giving us income before net operating loss, subtracting that net operating loss, giving us income before our dividend received deduction, subtracting that dividend received deduction, giving us taxable income times our tax rate of 21%, giving us gross tax liability minus tax credits, which we just spoke about, bringing us to estimated tax payments. So corporations are expected to make estimated payments if their estimated tax is expected to be $500 or more. And then the payment schedule really follows the same as individuals, with one exception: first quarter, April 15th, second quarter, June 15th, third quarter, September 15th. And then finally, the fourth quarter, and this is different from individuals, December 15th. So individuals is due January 15th of the following year. For corporations, the fourth quarter payment is due December 15th. So I don't know. Could the CPA exam, especially TCP, ask you on that? Maybe. So that's what I would remember. So going back to form 1120, gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contributions given as income before net operating losses minus net operating losses given as income before dividend received deduction minus dividend received deduction given as taxable income times the tax rate given as gross tax liability minus tax credits minus estimated payments plus underpayment penalties and interest. So if you don't make those estimated payments, then you can be charged interest and penalties. And the IRS does not mess around. They and so like they want their money when it's due, and they don't mess around. And so they charge a high rate of interest, and it's a big deal. So the long and short of it, make your estimated payments on time. Going back to Form 1120, gross income minus ordinary deduction. You're like, not again, Jeff. Stay with me. Gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contribution deductions, giving us income before NOL, backing out those NOLs, income before dividend received deduction minus that dividend received deduction, giving us taxable income times the tax rate, giving us gross tax liability minus tax credits minus estimated tax payments plus underpayment penalties and interest plus accumulated earnings tax or personal holding company tax, whatever the case may be. Accumulated earnings tax. This is designed to discourage corporations from hoarding their retained earnings. And the accumulated earnings tax is not self-assessed, but it's rather imposed by the IRS, and it's 20%. Now, the personal holding company tax, this is for personal holding companies, so it's for corporations with five or fewer, where five or fewer individuals own more than 50% of the stock and at least 60% of the adjusted ordinary gross income is from passive sources like dividends, interest, rent, etc. Now, the difference between the accumulated earnings tax and the personal holding company tax is the accumulated earnings tax is not self-assessed. The personal holding company tax is self-assessed. So that is a notable difference to pay attention to on exam day. Going back to Form 1120. This is the last time, I promise. Thank you for hanging with me. Gross income minus ordinary deductions minus charitable contribution deductions given as income before net operating loss deduction minus that net operating loss deduction given as income before special deduction, which is dividend received deduction, minus that dividend received deduction given as taxable income times the tax rate, given as gross tax liability minus tax credits minus estimated tax payments plus underpayment penalties and interest plus accumulated earnings tax or personal holding company tax, depending on the size of the company, plus BEAT, Base Erosion Anti-Abuse Tax. Now, to prove that I didn't just mail it in and copy the corporate tax audio that I did for regulation, because I didn't, because this one is much, much, much more in-depth, I made a reference to BEAT and a Michael Jackson song, but I didn't sing it for you. So, the other one had singing as well, but something else. Anyway, as soon as I saw it, I was like, dun, dun, dun. Anyway. Base Erosion Anti-Abuse Tax. So, because of TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the dividends received deduction is available on dividends received from foreign corporations with 10% or more ownership. Now, these corporations, they can reduce their U.S. tax liability by paying deductible expenses to foreign corporations and then receiving the income as dividends tax-free. So the BEAT provisions work to counteract this by making sure that a minimum amount of tax is paid on income. It's kind of AMT-ish in spirit. So the minimum amount of taxes paid on income, even after accounting for these deductible payments and dividends received. So it adds back certain deductible payments made to foreign-related parties to the U.S. Corp's taxable income, effectively increasing the amount of income that's subject to tax. So that's what it is. It applies to corporations with annual gross receipts of at least $500 million over the previous three tax years. So, going back to Reform 1120, just kidding, we're done. Moving on to earnings and profit, current earnings and profits, and accumulated earnings and profits. Earnings and profits is a tax concept used to measure a C-Corp's ability to pay dividends to its shareholders. So it's similar to the accounting concept of retained earnings, but it's calculated differently due to different rules and objectives of financial accounting and tax law. So this is key to determining the taxability of corporate distributions to shareholders, since distributions are taxable as dividends to the extent of earnings and profits. Now, there's two types of earnings and profits. There's current earnings and profits and accumulated earnings and profits. Current earnings and profits represent the earnings and profits generated during the current tax year. It's all of the income earned during the tax year minus deductions with adjustments for certain items. The current earnings and profits, it's computed in a manner similar to taxable income. However, there's several adjustments that must be made to taxable income to arrive at earnings and profits. So here it is. Just kind of mentally walk through this with me. Taxable income plus tax exempt income plus life insurance proceeds on the death of a key employee. Remember, we didn't include that earlier. Add refunds of federal income tax paid. Add dividend received deduction. Add excess depreciation under tax in Section 179. Add any organizational expense amortization. Add net operating loss deductions that have reduced the current year's taxable income. Add capital loss carryforwards that have reduced the current year's taxable income. Add charitable contribution carryovers that have reduced the current year's taxable income. Remember, there was that 10% threshold. Subtract expenses to earn tax-exempt income. Subtract federal income taxes paid. Subtract any non-deductible fines, penalties, political contributions, etc. Subtract non-deductible meals and entertainment. Subtract life insurance premiums for key employees. Subtract current year non-deductible capital losses. And then finally, subtract current year non-deductible charitable contributions. And that was a lot. Just kind of mentally get the big picture. That gives you current earnings and profits. Then you have accumulated earnings and profits, and these represent the total earnings and profits that a corporation has generated over its entire existence, reduced by the dividends it's paid out in past years and any previous deficits in current earnings and profits. It's a cumulative number that carries over from year to year. And it's kind of like retained earnings. It's opening accumulated earnings and profit, add or subtract current earnings and profits, subtract distributions. So cash distributions, you subtract the amount that's distributed, or property distributions, you subtract the higher of the fair market value or basis minus liabilities on that property, giving you closing accumulated earnings and profit. Moving on to non-liquidating distributions. So non-liquidating distributions are those distributions after which the C Corp would still be in business. So distributions can be made in cash, property, or stock. And we will go over this from the shareholder perspective and also the corporation's perspective. So if the shareholder distributes, if the corporation distributes cash, then the distribution amount is the amount of cash received. If property is distributed, then the distribution amount for the non-liquidating distribution is the fair market value of the property minus the liability of the property. Stock is the fair market value of the stock. So cash, amount of cash, property, fair market value of the property minus liability, stock, fair market value of the stock, the tax treatment. So again, from the shareholder's perspective, up to the higher of current earnings and profits or current earnings and profits plus accumulated earnings and profits, it's a taxable dividend taxed at ordinary income tax rates. If it's beyond the current earnings and profits and the accumulated earnings and profits, but up to the basis, then it's a non-taxable return of capital, and it reduces the shareholder's basis in the C-Corp stock. If it's beyond the basis, it's a taxable capital gain taxed at capital gain rates. Kind of a hard thing to grasp in an audio. For a corporation that distributes cash, no gain or loss recognized. Property, the gain is recognized, but losses are not recognized. Stock, no gain or loss is recognized. So again, those were non-liquidating distributions. Next up is liquidating distributions. So this occurs when a corporation is dissolved and the remaining assets are distributed to the shareholders. Liquidating distributions are the final distribution made by the C Corp. And after the distribution, the corporation ceases to exist. Liquidating distributions can be in the form of cash or property, not stock, obviously. So corporate liquidation results in double taxation. At the corporate level, when the corporation sells its assets and distributes the net proceeds to the shareholders, the corporation must pay a tax on the gain realized from the sale of the assets. And the gain is generally the difference between the sale price and the corporation's basis in the assets. From the shareholder perspective, after the corporate level tax, then the remaining proceeds are distributed to the shareholders, and then they must recognize the income based on what they received in excess of their stock basis. So, liquidating distribution scenario one. The C Corp distributes cash. From the corporation's perspective, no gain or loss is recognized when the C Corp distributes cash to the shareholder as a liquidating distribution. Cash is cash. From the shareholder perspective, there's a gain or loss. The shareholder will recognize a gain or loss on the liquidating distribution, which is calculated as follows. Cash minus basis in their stock, giving them a gain or loss on their stock. And their basis in the cash, it's the amount of cash. Liquidating distribution scenario two. The C Corp sells property and distributes cash. So this is a situation where it sells its property and then distributes the cash from that sale as a liquidating distribution to the shareholders. And so here are the tax implications. So the C Corp sells property, then distributes the cash. The C Corp will recognize the gain or loss on the sale of property, which is the cash they received minus the basis in their property, giving them gain or loss on the sale of that property. From the shareholder's perspective, they will recognize a gain or loss on the liquidating distribution, which is cash minus the basis of stock, giving them a gain or loss on the stock, and their basis in the cash is the cash received. Cash is cash. Liquidating distribution Scenario 3, the C-Corp distributes property. When they distribute property to the shareholders as part of a liquidating distribution, the corporation recognizes the gain as if it sold the property at the fair market value. From the shareholder's perspective, the liquidating distribution is a sale of stock, as after the liquidating distribution, the corporation will end and the stock will be surrendered. So the shareholder will recognize the gain on the sale of stock. But there's still some scenarios with that where the property is not subject to any liability, or the property is subject to a liability and the liability on the property is less than the fair market value of the property. That's ideal. Or the property is subject to a liability and the liability on the property is more than the fair market value of the property. So the first scenario, the property where the property is subject to a liability. From the corporation's perspective, the corporation will recognize the gain or loss on the sale of the property, which is the fair market value of the property minus the basis, giving them the gain or loss. From the shareholder perspective, they will recognize a gain or loss on the liquidating distribution, which is the fair market value of the property minus their basis in the stock, giving them the gain or loss. Now, the shareholder's basis in that property is calculated as follows. It's their basis in the C-Corp stock plus or minus the gain or loss recognized equals the fair market value. Next scenario, the property is subject to a liability and that liability is less than the fair market value. So the corporation will recognize a gain or loss on the sale of the property, which is fair market value minus basis, given the gain or loss on the distribution. The shareholder will take the fair market value of the property minus the liability that they assumed minus their basis of stock, giving them a gain or loss on the stock. So their basis is the basis in the C-Corp stock plus or minus the gain or loss recognized plus the liability assumed. Final scenario, the property is subject to a liability and that liability is greater than the fair market value of the property. So from the corporation will recognize the gain or loss on the sale of the property, which is the liability minus the basis of the property, giving them the total gain realized. From the shareholder's perspective, when the corporation distributes property subject to a liability and the liability is greater than the fair market value of the property, the shareholder will recognize a loss on the sale of the corporate stock. However, the loss is limited to the shareholder's basis in the stock. So basis in stock minus loss recognized plus liability assumed equals their liability. So that was liquidating distributions. Next, we will discuss stock redemptions and corporate reorganizations. Stock redemptions are when a corporation buys back its own shares from the marketplace, reducing the number of outstanding shares. This can be done for a variety of reasons, including to increase the value of remaining shares or to prevent other shareholders from taking a controlling stake or if they have extra cash. Now, there are some tax consequences, and the redemption is classified either as a proportionate redemption or a disproportionate redemption. In a proportionate redemption, the corporation repurchases shares from shareholders in a way that their percentage ownership in the corporation remains the same. When this happens, the proceeds received is treated as a dividend distribution and taxed as dividend income. In a disproportionate redemption, the corporation repurchases shares in a way that the shareholder's percentage ownership in the corporation changes. When this happens, it's treated as a sale of the stock by the shareholder and a capital gain or loss is recognized. So proportionate redemption is dividend income. Disproportionate redemption, it's a capital gain or loss. So with stock redemptions, let's talk about the excise tax on stock redemptions. There's something called the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, and that included a new 1% excise tax on the repurchases of corporate stock. And it's designed to discourage corporations from buying back their own stock, which can artificially inflate stock prices and benefit wealthy shareholders. Corporate reorganizations. This refers to a significant restructuring of the company's business operations or their legal structure. And there are seven types of corporate reorganizations. There's type A, which is a merger. Type B, stock for stock. Type C, stock for assets. Type D, divisive. Type E, recapitalization. Type F, a change in entity, form, or place. Or type G for bankruptcy. And what I want to focus in on are the tax consequences of reorganization. So a corporate reorganization is considered a mere restructuring. It's generally a tax-free event. But it can impact the shareholders. So for shareholders, no gain or loss is recognized to the shareholders who are involved in a tax-free reorganization. However, if they receive other property in addition to the stock, like Boot, and then it's treated as a gain, is recognized equal to the lower of the Boot received or the realized gain. With the corporation, a gain or loss is generally not recognized to the corporation. So that's the tax side, the gain or loss side. For basis in stock, from the shareholder's perspective, the shareholder's basis in the stock received is the basis in the stock surrendered plus any capital gain recognized minus any Boot received. And from a corporation, from their perspective, the acquiring corporation's basis in the property equals their transfer's basis in the property. Probably a nuanced thing, but just wanted to quickly cover it. Taxation of foreign source income. So U.S. corporations with foreign operations generate their income through several avenues. You have sale of goods, licensing, investments, intercompany transactions, interest, and dividends. What I want to focus on here is the taxability of income from foreign operations. And there's the foreign branch, which is not a separate legal entity from the corporation. Instead, it's an extension of the U.S. corporation itself for tax purposes. The corporation includes the income and expenses of the foreign branch on its own tax return. And the income of the foreign branch is subject to the U.S. tax in the year it's earned, regardless of whether or not it's repatriated back to the U.S. So income from the foreign branch is taxed when earned at the corporate tax rate. And when it's repatriated back to the U.S., it's eligible for a 100% dividend received deduction. And there's foreign subs. A foreign subsidiary, on the other hand, is a separate legal entity from the U.S. Corp. It's usually incorporated under the laws of the foreign country where it operates. So foreign branch, not a separate legal entity. A foreign sub is a separate legal entity. That'd be a good distinction to know. So those are foreign branches and foreign subs. What I want to hit on real quickly is the taxation. So foreign branches are taxed when earned at the corporate tax rate. Foreign subs are taxed only when repatriated. The money comes back to the U.S. subject to a 100% dividend received deduction. Real quickly, I want to cover what's called a Section 965 inclusion. So essentially, the way that the tax code was structured, U.S. corporations would keep the profits earned by their foreign subs overseas to avoid additional U.S. tax upon repatriation, leading to a buildup of undistributed foreign earnings. Now, to counter this, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act allowed a 100% dividend received deduction. So that's what I would know about Section 965 inclusion. Okay, wrapping up corporate income tax, I want to talk about the impact of changes in tax legislation, because this really gets into tax planning and the impact of changes in future tax rates. It's part of what tax planning is. So if it is expected that future legislation will increase the deductibility of expenses, then taxpayers will want to defer these expenses until the new legislation takes place. So this could mean postponing planned purchases, delaying maintenance, repairs, etc. Makes sense. If future legislation is expected to decrease the deductibility of those expenses, conversely, then you want to do that now. Or if future legislation is expected to increase the tax on income, then businesses might ask clients to pay sooner, or and then there's some other tax strategies, like if for an individual might involve taking a bonus or other income early, and investors might want to sell assets to recognize gains in the current year. If it's expected that taxes are going to decrease in the future, then businesses will want to delay. And if it's an individual, it might mean asking an employer to defer a bonus or other compensation. Or investors might want to hold on to assets longer to recognize gains in the year, where they'll be taxed less. This concludes C Corporation Taxation.